Yhteistyössä Helsinki Biennaali, nykytaidetta Vallisaaressa, Esplanadin puistossa ja HAM Helsingin taidemuseossa.
Hei arvon kuulijat ja tervetuloa taas lähetyksen pariin. Tänäänkin tässä ja nyt keskustellaan Helsinki Biennaalesta kahden taiteilijan kanssa. Studiossa heppukoiran lisäksi on myöskin kaksi taiteilijaa, joiden töitä nähdään tuolla Vallisaaressa sekä myös täällä Mantereen puolella. Nomena Urbonas, hei.
Hei.
And Gediminas Urbonas, hello.
Hello, hello.
How are you guys doing?
Thank you, we are very good.
Yeah, we are fantastic, yeah. Thank you.
You have just come from Vallisaari to the main continent and this is... I'm speaking like Vallisaari is like somewhere far, far away. But in a way, maybe mentally it is. There is a sort of, when you travel the 20 minutes from the Kauppatori to Vallisaari, it is actually like a
journey.
Yeah, and it takes in this magic way, you know, it takes you from the mundane sounds, from the traffic noise, from anything that you are surrounding in the city. And there is something really incredible traveling by boat because, well, we, unlike many people living in Helsinki, we do not live in archipelago, for example. So for us, travel by boat reminds of the childhood experience of holidays of some special time, you know, that maybe you only have this experience when you go to Venice and you travel with Vaporetto. So it is travel by boat is about special time.
Hey, let's go to Vallisaari, like, concretely and talk about your work there, because it's called Futurity Island. In Finnish, it's Tulevaisuussaari, and it's, well, okay, I let you guys describe it. What do we see when we see your artwork? What's happening there? What do we see or hear or feel?
Well, we see a stack of pipes. In the blue, very bright blue color, and the feeling should kind of like actually bring this wonder: what the heck these industrial pipes in the industrial scale doing in this pristine, untouched nature of Vallisaari Island?
I would not agree with you, as usually I do. I would say, like, first you see some, right. Very bright blue color, but not a stack. You see it like, you know, in between the trees, and you see some like shimmering blue thing in the background. Actually, it's not very clear what it is. You know, you really have to like walk to the crossing where two paths like lead you towards like either shorter way or like a little bit longer way around the island, and there are like some points where you can like finally see the stack, but in the beginning you don't see it.
Okay, and then you realize that this is not a simple stack, but there is a certain geometrical interplay with the sizes, with the diameters, and also with the system of how these pipes put together. So definitely you can recognize that it is different than you would experience maybe in the harbor or maybe industrial site or a factory. So there must be a certain kind of like logic of structure that is kind of like, you know, invested there. There is a certain intelligence, if you will. And then what you start also experiencing as you come closer, there is a sound that meets you and invites you to either climb on the structure or also come inside the structure, almost like transform your body into a different type of life form, I guess.
Yeah, and the sound, you know, if you are just passing by, sometimes depending on the direction of the wind, you might even miss the sound, you know, because it really like melts with the environment. And especially here in this location in Vallisaari, you have a lot of like nature, a lot of wind, and you know, depends on the angle, on the corner, how you approach the island, it might, you know, seem like there is a wind playing, and that's of course intentional.
I have to ask about the color, because the color of the pipes, it is really distinctively blue. It's something, it's Maybe the kind of shade of blue that you can see maybe in hospitals or I don't know, something like maybe the color of the mask that you wore during COVID or something. I think it's something like maybe sterile or something that is totally not from the nature. The color is like not unnatural, I would say, but something that is not naturally there. But did you sort of like pick the color or was it more like, okay, these pipes wear this color?
It's funny. Yeah, we definitely have many, you know, things to say about the color. It goes like back to like the beginning, you know, of the piece or like origins of the piece, so to say, and the ideas. But what I wanted to say, actually, when you spoke about the color and saying like it's not natural, I actually yesterday took a picture, which I called like new nature or like no nature, because it was just the sky and the pipes. So there is an angle when you look into the piece, you know, from above or actually from the ground, and then you see the sky on top without any like leaves or any like branches of the tree, and basically the structure melts into the sky. So the sky yesterday was the light, which was like same intensity of the blue as the pipes, and they were like, you know, of the same tone, of the same color. So it basically melted with the sky. So in a way, yeah, it looks not natural, but yesterday it was like, you know, of the same color as the universe, so to say. So I noticed that, you know, it was just like this one moment. Otherwise, there is another thing. Yeah, we can talk about like why blue maybe a little later, but I don't know if you, in the picture what you have in front of you, you see what it's not entirely blue anymore. Mm. It used to be very blue and very precise blue, but now it's like, you know, kind of grayish and whitish and paled, and it's getting more and more paled from the sun, and also it gets like some, you know, damages, and the surface is not perfect anymore, and almost like mimics the birch trees which are around, and we really like that part of it. It becomes like, you know, part of this environment.
Yeah, this artwork is not made to Vallisaari. It has had life before. Can you tell us where this work was sort of originally born and where has it traveled?
So originally the piece was conceived for Venice Biennale Architecture Exhibition in 2018 when we co-curated and co-organized the Swamp School in Venice, in Lagoon. And this island was designed to float on the water. We could not realize and we could not get a permission to build this island on the water in Venice because of zillion questions and liability issues. The same time, curator Christina Shaw from Toronto Mississauga University in Canada learned about our proposal and invited us to Toronto. It happened like in a week. We went to Toronto and we discussed with her, and she said, despite it was not possible to build it in Venice, I want to build it on the water of Ontario Lake. And she was organizing large intervention in the industrial zone of Toronto, Mississauga, where there is a refinery, cement factory, water treatment facility, and we were planning to make this island connected with the industrial territory and the title of Clean Harbors, where they bring toxic mud from different ports in Canada, in the East Canada, and they're using phytoremediation. So they're using plants to remediate the soil from the different toxic materials, heavy metal, and so on and so forth. So on one hand, we worked with the Environmental Protection Agency to get the data, how much this bioremediation is actually successful and productive. And then we try to mix this data So this is early version of the piece with the sounds of Trichoptera larva, which is the caddisfly larva that lives under the sea and is natural, we could say, sensor or indicator of the water quality. So the pipes for that piece were donated from the IPEX company that produces the high density plastic pipes for the transportation of the potable water. You never see those pipes in the soil, right? So never see them. You never see these pipes exposed in the ear.
They are always underground.
Mm. Yeah, okay. And the color is not that they are colored, you know. It is just this color comes from this specific plastic material. It has to do with the production kind of specificity. As these pipes, as they engineered to transport potable water, so there is a physical condition that it should not leach any plastics into the environment, neither into the soil nor into the water. And so when we arrived to Canada, we saw these pipes being this color, you know. So basically,
we had no choice,
you know. Okay. And then we were a bit shocked when we saw this bright color. And then we started to think, would it be better that they would be yellow or, you know, like
black or white,
you know, like. And so in a way, it was very interesting that we got this secondhand pipes donated by this company, and the color was like that, you know. Mm. So we just had to embrace it and think, how can we reuse them?
And now these pipes are in Vallisaari. What kind of dialogue there is between this work that originally was born to another environment and now it's here? What kind of sort of, are there any new questions that you are thinking about, or is it more like just like seeing and waiting for something to appear, or how do you sort of see this work in Vallisaari? What does it bring to your mind?
For me, you know, it was always the idea that the work will not travel anywhere. So as Gediminas told the story how, you know, we build it in Toronto, the idea was it will be recycled and it will go back to the factory and the new pipes will be produced out of it. But the story goes that university really liked the piece and everyone liked the piece and they wanted it to be on their grounds. And so it was a decision taken by the curator that the piece will go to the storage. So while it was sitting in the storage, there was another idea that maybe it should travel to Boston, where actually we are residing for 15 years already. And that it would be great to like show it to our community in Boston and build it, you know, there. And so it would just sit there. And in general, it was against maybe our will to like transport it somewhere because it's so giant and and heavy, and you know, you get even like horrified by the very idea what it will travel somewhere. But then it was another funny thing that also some kind of coincidence that the curator found the transportation company who just acquired the zero emission truck. And beautiful new Volvo truck, and they wanted to sponsor this this journey and make a movie about that, you know. So we even had to design the tent for the truck, you know, saying like the island is moving, and it was like a beautiful title, Swamp on the Move, which was designed with our friend Serge Romsa, designers from Berlin. And then, you know, the movie was also very beautiful of island traveling, you know, to Boston. And once it was installed in Boston, we also had, you know, another location, totally different setting. And that was also very interesting, you know, to try and see what kind of new dimensions this new situation brings. It was very different from Toronto site, and yeah, different constellation, different references around
Yeah, we installed it on MIT campus, the campus that historically has been a swamp. Drained.
Yeah.
And of course, we're very much interested in these dialectics of swamps that have the ancient knowledge, maybe prehistoric knowledge, and or we can say also pre-Christian knowledge, you know, and you can say also maybe the knowledge that comes from the witchcraft or knowledge that comes from mythology, and then the human knowledge, which is university, MIT, you know. So this kind of like knowledge that comes with enlightenment, you know, with classification, supersedes this old prehistoric, you know, ways of engaging and knowing the world. And the island was kind of like trying to connect and negotiate, you know, these two knowledges. It was also built in the close proximity with the Department of Earth Atmospheric Planetary Sciences. And we worked again with the scientists there who are using the sensors and in detecting pollution in the environment. So from the inception, in both of the instances, whether in Canada or in Boston, United States, we conceived the island as a learning environment, you know, that was the idea, that instead of sitting in our classrooms in university, we should bring the participants, including our students and collaborators, to the island, you know, as destination.
Yeah.
And be exposed to the sounds of the environment, but also pollution of the environment, you know, whether in the mud, in the sea, or in the water, or in the air, you know, as our bodies are, you know, in one way or the other way, are also like sponges, right? So we are sucking with our bodies through our life different type of, different type of things, different type of toxic, not toxic, you know. So we wanted to make this island as a learning environment to understand our entanglement and our interdependency, not only to each other, not only to, you know, more than humans, but to all the environmental forces that surround us. And that's how we started to build collaborations and also build the system that could help us to listen to the invisible, invisible elements, invisible particles, invisible and maybe even inaudible vibrations, and how can we make them heard? How can we make them experienced?
Yeah, so a material engineer or material scientist, Markus Bühler, who is at the Nano Center at MIT, he made he basically collected a library of samples of the Trichoptera or caddisfly saliva protein, like a protein which is a base of that, you know, very specific material what caddisfly has in the stage of larva, because larva builds its own house, a tubular structure, which is her sort of like casing. So she's a natural architect, and her house
pipe maker.
Yeah, exactly. So so this was like very important, parallel for us between this like insect world and the human made world, which the structure is, and Markus actually, yes, he created that collection, and that's like a new layer of the sound what we are using for in the occasion of Vallisaari and the Helsinki Biennial. Mm. We are in the process of fabricating the new vinyl LP.
Okay.
Which will be released, you know, soon, and we have like starring artist for that vinyl, and Grönlund and Nissen. Perhaps you know the Finnish duo, electronic sound artist, who are also starring. Yeah. You know,
I have to play them later in the program.
Yes,
definitely. Yeah,
we can also definitely share, you know, like snippets from the LP.
Yeah.
That would be super. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we had actually to dive into the most invisible and inaudible level, which is the nano level at MIT Nano Lab, in order to really understand this, well, to grapple with the structure of the protein. So what we found in this collaboration with Markus Buhler, the materials engineer, that they're using acoustics to dissect protein structures to analyze possibility of how to design new materials. And looking into the specific protein structure of caddisfly larvae, we then translate that back into the sound composition. So if you talk about the structures, you know, we have structures on the different levels. We have a architectural structure of how we are stacking the pipes to make it into the sound instrument. Then we have a structure of the distribution of the sound sources in terms that we are using six ultrasonic transducers that are installed in this pipe structure, in the way that it would create different experiences. We could say, well, there are six channels, so perhaps there are three or four different experiences depending where you are in the structure inside. And then there is, of course, the structure of the sound itself, right? And then there is a structure of the net that this larva is weaving as the species living on the bottom of the bodies of water, as it creates certain nets that are solidifying sediment and preserving pieces of algae or other sources of food to be kind of like stuck in this structure, which is very generous for other species, for the snails or for the fishes or for crustaceans or small crabs who are crawling on the bottom and looking for the food. So otherwise it would be washed by the water, you know. But now it's getting stuck into this net that is similar to the spider web. But of course it is a miracle how this little larva weaves this spider web under the water, right? So so for scientists, it is miraculous in a way, the binding quality of this saliva or this protein.
It sounds like research, like science and art goes, like, I don't know, like integrally hand in hand in your thinking and in your artistic practice, or even artistic practice, like just your practice. It's not, it's like a combination of so many things. Then, and my background is also like I'm in the middle of my own PhD studies, and I'm also doing artistic research, and I every day wonder how could I sort of resolve the question of bringing research into practice and practice into research. But it sounds like you have sort of like solved it quite, you know, like naturally. It's there. You don't have to question it, like where does the research come into place in your practice. It sounds like, you know, it's like a dialogue between the two, like all the time. Do you like agree, or do you find it sometimes problematic to combine artistic views or artistic thinking into science or like scientific research?
Certainly we find it problematic. And, you know, we've been working at MIT for 16 years, and MIT is a research university, first of all, and it has very, very little graduate program in art, science that offers Master of Science in Art, Culture and Technology. And there is a question for us as for artists, and this program, in fact, has been more than 50 years. And I think during these 50 years, we've been there only 16 years, but I think that during these 50 years, and as we studied the archives of the of our predecessors and people working there, starting with Georgi Kepes, who was Bauhaus-trained artist, and all other people, Marian Amischer, amazing sound artist, who was there. Everyone, I think, being in close proximity to science, to technology to all these laboratories, they had question, I think, what are we doing here? but I think if we look in, back into our work, when we started to work with, in 2000, the transaction project that was also shown documented, 2002, with Oku Enbezor, I think our drive was the shift from illustration, art that illustrates, art that merely represents, into art that becomes operative. Art that has a certain also function, and there is this function in the project always that is inherent, and the tension that it produces between the representation and the operation. And I think by itself, I think, could you say, no matter that we arrived naturally, but I think it's always the question is what is happening with the work itself when it becomes operative?
Yeah, I don't know, like, I always think what maybe it's like just... us being, you know, raised or being like formed and informed very much by the certain time and certain moment in history when we were, I don't know, like I consider ourselves like in the avant-garde of the certain, like, you know, changes. I'm meaning like these like real fundamental political and geopolitical changes that happened in the 90s, and I think they were very formative, and at that time we already like realized what we have to be, like those pioneers who go and, you know, explore the world, and the art has to be like very much different from everything what you see around. So basically it's very, I don't know, like modernist, but also like in a way avant-gardist sort of like code that art, what else can be art, yeah? You are not like satisfied with what you see around, or you sort of like, once you name it, what this is art, it's like clear, and we don't want to repeat that, and we want to go and do something else. And I think this tendency or like, in a way, attraction to the operative art comes from like that drive for me, because it really, you know, I'm not like interested anymore in representation, but I want like sometimes, you know, something what could not like look like art, could not like be called that, like do something else, you know, and wait until it gets recognized as an art project. So I think, you know, maybe this natural feeling of mixing, you know, art with many different other fields comes from that wish, but it has to be something else, not what we call it art, but we have to like almost like reinvent ourselves every day.
Yeah.
And also for us, you know, the social dimension, the meta dimension, the changes in the 90s, societal transformation, transitioning from the socialism to capitalism, from the planned economy to the market economy, privatization of what's been owned, let's say, by the state, you know, the privatization of the public space, common goods, and I think in these processes you inevitably starting to ponder of the political and social dimension of art, or what agency art, what agency culture has in these processes. And then, of course, granular thinking, the relationship between art and culture. So maybe if culture is about sedimentation, then art breaks through the sedimentation. So thinking of this kind of like really... role of art that is disrupt certain ways of knowing and disrupt certain convictions and certain traditions, and through that maybe instigates new dimension, I don't know, new time, you know, or new platform, or new public space, you know, and again, contributes to sedimentation and again breaks through. So in this sense, we start kind of like embracing this agency, but also thinking about this operative function of art, not only representative, but really operative. So how can art become operative and mobilizing people? And then you start, you know, we're arriving to this piece, Futurity Island, actually thinking how the human sociability can be expanded to include others, to include modern humans or non-human species, right? To listen to their vibrations, or listen to the worlds that are completely inaudible to the human ear. So, of course, this interest that comes kind of like from the reflection of the society and the reflection of human and non-human society requires certain research, you know. So in a way, requires certain, first of all, dialogue with people coming from other fields, and then also the instruments that people working in other fields can also offer and lend, you know, or borrow, and then you sort of like start smuggling knowledge between these fields, you know, field of science and field of art, bringing forth and back and seeing, you know, about its relevance.
And I think the way of thinking, as you just described, is I would say vital in the times that we are living right now, 2025, when we are in the midst of all kinds of crises, climate crisis and political crises. Tables are turning all the time, and for example, climate crisis is phenomena that it goes through so many layers of the society that it's really hard to understand, because everything gets more complicated all the time and every day. So and politics are all the time like mixing the constellations even more. So art or artists and scientists, or artists and politicians or everything, everyone together maybe can sort of offer new ways of grasping and understanding these complex times that we are living. I mean, this is something that I've been thinking a lot, that what could my research sort of offer. And maybe something like this could be like the beginning of sort of bigger things, for at least for me in the future. I hope so. But what are your thoughts about artists living in these times and you know, trying to make your practice operative, and what are the participants of these operations? What are your thoughts on these things?
Well, certainly, I think what is missing these times is aesthetic judgment. I think if politicians would have obligatory courses in aesthetics and visual literacy, we would have much more just world, aesthetically and ethically just world. First of all, aesthetic teaches us, even if we look at this concept of bricolage, so we could say aesthetics teaches us how to put two things that do not belong to each other and create a meaningful joint, almost like in design or in architecture, when you have to put two things together, you have to design a joint, right? So if we use this joint as a metaphor of putting two things together to create a new meaning, right? So aesthetics teaches us how to do that. I think visual literacy also teaches us how to observe things, and be more sensitive, how to attune, how to spend more time. There is a saying that animals knows more about us because they spend all their life watching us. So visual, I think if we are, entering the world of visual literacy, we would spend more time maybe watching plants, watching trees, watching sky, watching animals, and becoming more sensitive and perhaps more, more mindful, but also maybe more diplomatic people. Because I think diplomacy that is informed by this aesthetic sensibility, it is what is missing in this world.
Thank you, Nomeda and Gediminas, for being here, and best of summer.
Thank you
so much. Thank you for inviting us.
Yhteistyössä Helsinki Biennaali. HelsinkiBiennaali.fi.